Hey, Keith, it's nice having you on.
Thanks for having me back, Robert.
So where I want to get started is your article about it's by Joel Kotkin. It's not your article, but it's an article you linked to by Joel Kotkin, and it's about California, California's model for 21st century American feudalism. I think a good way to get started is let's introduce who is Joel Kotkin, and I know he basically wrote a book called The Next 100 Million Americans. And I wasn't a fan of that book. He basically defends the overpopulation and a demographic transformation of the country in a positive light. But on the other hand, he does talk a lot about the importance of a strong middle class, and he does talk about the issue that you talk about, where the current plutocracy within the Democratic Party is how they be basically like the Silicon Valley, how they become plutocratic economically but culturally leftist. So what is that? What is your take personally on Joel Kotkin?
Well, the interesting thing about Kotkin's article is the way that he describes what is happening in California, in the sense that California is, on one hand, one of the more liberal states in the United States in a cultural sense, and it's certainly a state that's experiencing perhaps the greatest amount of demographic change brought on by immigration and things like that. At the same time, he also talks a bit in this article about how the process of reproletarianizing labor is also taking place, and this type of neo-feudalism, he calls it, is developing as well. And all of this is entirely predictable. If we look at the neoliberal model that developed it has its roots going back in the 1980s. But if you look at this neoliberal model that's developed over the last few decades and has now more or less become the dominant ideology of the Democratic Party, which is, of course, the ruling party in the United States at present,
But first of all, I want to introduce Joel Kotkin. How would you describe his ideology?
It's a little hard to say. Kotkin is a professor of urban development at Chapman University, I believe, and he writes about demographic trends as they relate to things like urbanization and the development of suburbs and that kind of stuff. He's also regularly promoted by the Cato Institute. The Cato Institute is a libertarian-oriented, an establishment libertarian think tank, what Kevin Carson always called vulgar libertarians.
I think they're funded by the Koch brothers.
They are. Founded by them. They were actually founded by them in the early 70s, yes.
So he talks about the situation in California, and you can get back to what you were describing about the neoliberal economics that go back to the 80s.
Well, the neoliberal economics is, first of all, not the same thing as neoconservatism. There's a tendency to use them to conflate the two concepts, but neoconservatism is a somewhat different phenomenon. But neoliberalism was a branch of thought that started to develop in the 80s and on into the 90s that more or less was very defensive of the rising upper middle class of the time. For example, in the 80s, you had the explosion of this yuppie class, this class of relatively young, upwardly mobile professional people that were in turn part of the growing information-based economy, the post-industrial information society, whatever you want to call it, economy. They were a part of that. They were also part of the ever-expanding professional class, the ever-expanding bureaucratic and managerial class that really started to develop, really in the post-war era, but it really started to take off in the 80s. So you had this yuppie class that emerged during that time, and you also had a lot of newly wealthy people, people who developed their wealth outside the confines of the traditional plutocracy. We're not talking about the old banking families and the Rockefellers and stuff like that. We're talking about people that were not born into wealth. You know, someone like Bill Gates, for example. You know, during that time, during the 80s, the 90s, you had the growth of this newly rich, this rising upper middle class, what they used to call yuppies. And these were people who were economically affluent and culturally very liberal. You know, these are not social conservatives by any means. And what happened is that starting with the Bill Clinton administration, this particular class started to gain access to real political power, which it had not had before. And now in the age of Obama, it's more or less become full circle where, you know, neoliberalism really is the dominant ideology of the state at present times. And we see this reflected in the kinds of things that are going on in California. On one hand, we see a dominant political paradigm that's very business friendly, very plutocrat friendly, very capitalism friendly, but is socially and culturally very liberal. And by extension, it welcomes this radical demographic change. And what that is, what all of these factors are doing is combining this, you know, this plutocratic model economy, the demographic change, immigration, all of these kinds of things are combining to create a very two-tiered society in a class sense. So you have it's interesting that as American society is becoming more liberal and more diverse, it's also becoming more stratified socioeconomically.
And he points out that as recently as the 1980s, and that's actually, if you think about it, that's not that long ago. I mean, California was overwhelmingly middle class, at least 60% of the population was middle class, and now the income inequality is on this. There's estimates that it's on the level of places like the Dominican Republic, and he even points out, he even says the Republic of Congo. I mean, that's about as bad as you can get.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting because California was once one of the most affluent of any of the American states, and now it's not necessarily the poorest state because there's the amount of aggregate wealth there is high still. It's not Mississippi or Arkansas or somewhere like that, but the class stratification that you have there is a sight to behold in many ways. And I've said on a lot of my podcasts and interviews before that what we're moving towards in the United States is a third world model economy, something like Brazil, where you have the elite and affluent in Brazil are as rich as the rich anywhere. To be a rich person in Brazil is to be as wealthy as any ruling class member of the ruling class or member of the affluent class anywhere in any society. But at the same time, you also have this intensely stratified socioeconomic system where you have people on the bottom layers in Brazil who are as poor as any poor class you would find anywhere in the world. And more parts of the United States are starting to resemble that. California is probably the most advanced in that direction, where, you know, you've got the folks who live in Malibu and Silicon Valley and things like that who are as wealthy as anyone. And then you have, as you just pointed out, sectors, socioeconomic and demographic sectors that are comparable to some of the sub-Saharan African countries, which is really rather phenomenal that something like that is happening in the United States. And as is often said, California is something of a bellwether for the rest of the United States. And I think we're going to start to see this trend expand throughout the United States in the years ahead, no doubt about it.
I know Kotkin wrote another article about the Silicon Valley, and he was basically saying the same thing that you're saying, how they are culturally leftist, and they donate a large portion. They're a large portion of the base of the Democratic Party in terms of donations. But if you look at their policies, they're very hostile towards unions, and they've successfully lobbied the Obama and the Democratic administration, and the Republicans went along with it as well for lower taxation. But they were originally the Silicon Valley. The people who founded it were, a lot of them were from a middle class background. But what they do is they consolidate all their wealth in the hands of a few. Then they import these H-1B visa workers to displace American workers.
Yeah, it's interesting how that trajectory is developed. It is a case where, on one hand, you have people who do seem to represent the, you know, some of the legends behind the American dream, the idea anybody can get rich, and you know, people that start off, you know, cooking up software in their garage or something like that become billionaires. That, you know, that kind of thing actually happened in Silicon Valley, and as a result, that class of the newly rich started to expand and become politically powerful. And it is interesting that out of that, you now have this, this which might be called pro-business leftism or whatever that's come out of that. It's a faction of the left. It's, you know, that's a capitalist left. There was actually, if you want to know more about what the neoliberals were about, there was an article. There's an old article from 1983 that's still available online. I saw it recently from the New Republic that talks about the rise of the neoliberals and what some of their ideas were. And this was back in the time when this whole social and cultural phenomena was just starting to develop. And that's something that came about in the 80s and 90s, the rise of a newly wealthy class, an upper middle class that was outside the traditional plutocracy and did not share the traditional cultural values of the American ruling class at all. It was this was a very cosmopolitan, leftward-leaning class, but one that all at the same time looked out for its own class interest.
So he talks about the oligarchs, which you got into. That's what you described. Then he talks about the clerisy. So who are the clerisy in today's age?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure of the article you're referring to. I can't really comment on that because I think you're talking about a different article than one I saw.
It's the one you linked to, but I'll go over it. So the new serfs are basically the large underclass, and like the people, like you have like the corporate agriculture in California in the Central Valley and in the Salinas Valley, and you have the urban proletariat in LA, and that's pretty much and the servant class for the upper class, like the maids and the gardeners. And that's pretty self-explanatory. Then you have the yeoman, and this is basically the people who are part of basically either the what's left of the middle class or as well as small business owners. And a lot of these, I mean, I'm not necessarily defending Republicans, but a lot of this demographic group, basically, they do make up the core demographic of what's left of the Republican Party in California. And a lot of the people involved in the Tea Party, they're basically middle-class people and small business owners. And he's basically saying that this group has become basically obsolete in California.
Yeah, well, what he's talking about there is particularly familiar with all the different forms of terminology that he's using, but
yeah, he calls them a permanent. He says in California, middle income Californians are becoming a permanent outsider group, much like the old third estate in the early medieval times.
Yeah, well, what he's talking about is a part of a wider trend where the traditional middle class, just standard middle America, middle class, Main Street middle America. That particular class is not only starting to shrink demographically, but it's also becoming more and more politically on the outside. And that is what a lot of the Tea Party phenomena was about. If you go and you look at the demographics of the people who make up the Tea Party, they tend to be middle to upper middle class people, usually older, usually white people. In other words, they're the traditional middle class, and they are starting to feel the economic squeeze. It's interesting because when the economic crash happened in 2008, it was really that class that got hit as bad as anyone. I mean, the poor people have already been poor. If you talk to a poor person today and say, well, what's your life like now as compared to before 2008, they probably wouldn't tell you there was much different. But for people from the middle class, it's been a lot different. Those are the people that have seen their homes foreclosed on. Those are the people that have unexpectedly found themselves out of work, and consequently they've gone through their savings, they've gone through their retirement accounts and things like that. I know in one of my other lives, in one of the lines of work that I'm in, I deal with people who live out in suburbia in different contexts all the time. And I meet people like this all the time, people who were once affluent people who live in neighborhoods that were that are seemingly very nice neighborhoods, who are now going through bankruptcy. They're in danger of having their homes foreclosed on. They aren't able to pay their kids college tuition. They've gone through their retirement accounts. And it's this particular class that made up much of the Tea Party demographic. And we're going to see this class continue to decline over time as class divisions become ever more widened.
And this group will become radicalized. I think if there is any kind of a third position like movement that arises in this country, it's not going to come from the sort of traditional far right demographic groups, but it's basically going to be people who are former members of the middle class.
Yeah, I think that that's very likely. I think that the entire spectrum of the political right is going to become more radical over time, even as its numbers are shrinking. And the reason for that is that many of its core constituencies are going to be experiencing greater political disenfranchisement. They're going to be experiencing greater economic decline. They're going to be losing their numbers and so forth. So I think the entire spectrum of the right will start to become more radical and develop a much more oppositional stance than what we've seen in the past. I mean, we've seen inklings of that already with the rise of, say, the Tea Parties, or, you know, what I've called in the past a permanent opposition right, and that is a right that is against the system no matter who's in power. You know, for example, the alternative right. The alternative right didn't exist a few years ago, and that's a tendency that, you know, whether you agree with all the different ideas found in it or not, it's more or less a permanent opposition right. The paleoconservatives, while perhaps not as prominent as they once were, are certainly a permanent opposition right. I mean, they're almost more anti-Republican than they are anti-Democrat. And I think that even within mainstream conservatism and the more conventional Republican Party-oriented right, I think we're going to see that as well. I think we're going to see the growth of movements oriented towards this declining middle class that becomes more outspoken in its opposition to the status quo, develops a more radical stance about a lot of things, and starts becoming more suspicious of the political establishment generally, you know, Democrat or Republican.
Yes, you're saying that there is a trend towards very much an anti-capitalist, anti-plutocrat direction among the declining middle class.
Yes. Well, I think over time we will start to see a form of economic populism develop that is oriented towards the declining middle class. And I think that will accompany the growth of anti-plutocratic or anti-capitalist or whatever you want to call them movements generally in the United States. For instance, I came across an interesting article that was published just recently by Peter Beinhart, who's a writer from the left, who argues that there's a new left that's arising that's much more critical of capitalism and the plutocracy and so forth, and that it's mostly among younger people, and it's it overlaps with the growth of some of these Occupy groups and that kind of thing. And this is a movement of educated younger people who have high expectations economically, but they're seeing those expectations frustrated by the state of the economy, and they're the fact that they have a college degree or even a graduate degree, and they're unable to get a job doing anything other than, say, waitressing or bartending. There seems to be a new left that's growing out of that. And I also think that with the decline of the middle class, and that's more younger people there, but I think with the decline of the middle class, we'll start to see among middle-aged to older people the rise of an economic, not necessarily an economic radicalism, but certainly an economic populism that moves past the kind of thing you see in these Tea Party groups, where it's all just about we're the Tea Party.
Yeah, it's basically it's a Tea Party. It's all the problem is all taxes and government, but they're okay. They're actually okay with the plutocracy.
Yeah. It's, I mean, their ideology is the same kind of thing you hear on these conservative talk radio programs. You know, what's really wrong with the world is the Democrats want to raise taxes on the rich and that kind of stuff. But I do think on the right and in the middle as well, we'll start to see more and more calls for efforts to curb the power of big capital and that kind of thing. I mean, for instance, you know, in past times, back during the era that NAFTA was being rammed through Congress, you had the emergence of people like Pat Buchanan, people that were, you know, Buchanan, who had been a Republican insider his whole career, a staunch Reaganite. He's still a Reagan apologist to this day. But he started moving more and more away from that kind of Reaganite economic model, more towards a type of, you know, populist nationalism or something like that. And I think we're going to see the growth of thinking of that type on the right as well in the future, as more and more middle class, you know, working to middle class, even upper middle class, predominantly white folks, you know, people who are accustomed to the suburban lifestyle, as they start seeing the rug being pulled out from underneath them economically, I think that's going to have a certain radicalizing effect.
I mean, I tend to focus on opposition movements that are, predominantly sort of a white working to middle class movements. But do you see any kind of opposition movements from the non-white proletariat against the elites?
Well, one thing that's interesting is that one of the ways that the Democratic Party has been able to secure an electoral majority for itself is through being the party of all of the traditional outgroups, and that is, you know, that the racial minority groups, the feminist movement, the gay rights, and all of that, the entire spectrum of that. But what's also interesting is as the economy declines and class divisions widen, it's going to be much, much more difficult to keep all of that together. And I've talked before in a lot of things I've done about what I call cracks in the PC coalition, and that is that I think that it's going to be difficult for the left, just the mainstream center left, to maintain unity among its ranks in the future as some of these cracks start to widen, including class divisions. And also, there's a growing disparity of income within the minority groups. For example, among blacks, you're starting to see much wider class divisions between the rising black middle class on one hand and then the black underclass or lumpen proletariat. I think also we're going to start to see more ethnic conflict among the minority groups, say between blacks and Hispanics and so forth.
In LA, that's a big thing. There's a growing conflict because basically the jobs that blacks have traditionally done, those jobs are basically gone to immigrants in Southern California, and they're basically a lot of them are leaving California.
Mm-hmm. And I think it will be difficult for the Democratic Party and the center left to keep its constituent groups in aligned with one another over time. I think you'll start to see these kinds of cleavages come to the forefront more and more, and eventually the Democratic coalition, the center left coalition, is probably going to start falling apart. Now, I tend to think that that's a rather durable coalition in the short run. I don't think this is something that's going to happen overnight. And I think that the political right, the mainstream Republican Party-oriented right, is in shambles right now. And I don't really see them making any kind of turnaround anytime soon. But I do think that at some point in the future, we will start to see a more radicalized right come along that does have a much less capitalism-friendly or much less plutocrat-friendly outlook than what we've seen more recently in some of these more mainstream manifestations of the right.
Yeah, kind of like the alternative, like the alternative right, for instance.
The alternative right or right-wing populism. And there's a lot of different forms this can take. It can be something ranging from a Buchanan-style economic nationalism, all the way over to fascism or anything in between. There's a lot of – I mean, there's as many different radical ideologies on the right as there are on the left, arguably more. There's Catholic distributism, there's social credit, all of these kinds of things have traditions on the right as well. I think over time we're definitely going to see a shift among the middle class towards away from this kind of corporate-friendly talk radio conservatism towards an economic radicalism or at least an economic populism that is critical of big capital and big business and that kind of thing.
Well, hopefully that means I'll be able to make a living off my radio show.
All right. Well, maybe so.
I'll be the new Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I do think that the if you want to call it the market for ideas like yours, I think will grow in the future. Because I do think that, like I said earlier, that the entire spectrum of the right is going to move in a more radical direction. As these class divisions widen, as the middle class starts to decline, as demographic change really starts to seep in, as political correctness starts to tighten its grip even more. You may have a future.
So you predict in the short term that we're talking about some long-term trends, but in the short term, basically the Democrats, we will become like California, we'll have a one-party system. And I see, basically the Republicans will become obsolete basically in either 2016 or 2020.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, California is often thought of as the bellwether for the rest of the country. And I think that what we see now is with the Democrats is with the beginning of a new partisan cycle it started in 2008 when Obama was elected. But if we look at the history of American partisan politics, political cycles where tend to run every 30 years or so, and meaning that you have one dominant political paradigm or political coalition that retains power for several decades, and then there's a shift and something else comes along, and that's more or less been the trend ever since the American Republic was founded. And prior to the Obama election in 2008, probably the last new paradigm shift of any major type had been when Richard Nixon was elected in 1968. Nixon more or less was elected as the candidate of the silent majority. That is at the time that Nixon became president, traditional, American, middle America, 1950 style America was still the majority. And he was largely elected president as the anti-New Left, the anti-counterculture, president. And that paradigm that he established, with things like the Southern Strategy and things like that, continued to work for the Republican Party on up through the George W. Bush era. Now, it's true, of course, that, after Nixon was run out of office, there was a backlash against that. Jimmy Carter came in. Yeah, after the recession in the early 90s, Bill Clinton was able to get elected. And he and really represented the beginnings of the neoliberal coming to power. And then, George W. Bush, George W. Bush administration more or less used the same strategy as the Nixon movement did 30, 40 years earlier. I remember when when Bush was running against Kerry in 2004, one thing that I thought was really interesting about that election was that there was about as much discussion of the war in Vietnam during that election as there was the war in Iraq. This was a year into the war in Iraq, and much of the election was arguing about the various military records of the candidates, Kerry and Bush, during the war in Vietnam. And I remember thinking to myself when that was going on, well, it's like the Vietnam War still going on. It's like the generational conflict and the cultural conflict that came out of that time period. The hard hats versus the hippies and that kind of stuff. It's almost like it's still going on. But I think that what happened with Barack Obama's election in 2008 is I think that represents a couple of things. First, it represents that the generational changeover and the demographic changeover had more or less come full circle, where where the so-called silent majority really wasn't the majority anymore, that there had been enough of a generational and cultural and demographic change that older majority had been displaced and a new majority had been found. And I think that it also represents in many ways the fact that this is an exaggeration, obviously, but it represents that the hippies had more or less finally won out over the hard hats in many ways, at least when it comes to, cultural values and so forth. And that paradigm really now is just beginning to be the dominant paradigm in terms of the national politics. And I think that the new cycle that Obama represents is going to be durable for quite some time. I don't think it's going to go away overnight. That's not to say that there couldn't be challenges that come along. I don't think, for example, there could be at some point a Republican politician who emerges as a sort of populist, middle class oriented politician who does a deal with some of these kinds of economic frustrations.
So yeah, you're saying that the Republicans have traditionally been the party for the rich, mm-hmm. but because once the Republican Party is going to be totally decimated, there could be an opportunity to rebuild the party from scratch, is what you're saying.
Well, there could be individuals within the Republican Party.
So not the party, but there's would be opportunities for individuals, you're saying?
Well, I mean, even in the past, you've had Republican candidates sort of on the fringes, like Buchanan was one to a lesser degree. Mike Huckabee, even at one point, was sort of taking things in a somewhat populist direction. I've seen things from the religious right in more recent times where they start questioning some of this pro-corporate sentiment that you see among the conventional Republicans. Now, I don't think any of this collectively is going to be enough to have any real movement. I mean, I think that all of that, to a large degree, represents cultural and demographic forces that are in a state of decline and are shrinking in size and therefore can only exercise limited influence on national politics. But I do think that there will be certainly be opportunities on the right for into leaders or movements or whatever organizations to emerge that do have a more populist or a more anti-capitalist, anti-plutocratic type of outlook in response to what's going on economically.
So you're talking about the short-term trends of the Democrats becoming the dominant party. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the long-term predictions? You say there's not going to be a major revolution or rebellion for at least another 30 to 40 years.
Yeah, well, I think the existing paradigm is going to be in place for a while. I think that over time, there's going to be an erosion of the middle class's standard of living, and there's going to be the growth of more and more younger people who are unemployed, who have done all the things that they're told to do. They went to school, they got their degrees. College enrollment is actually at an all-time high now. And what's interesting about that is that college degrees now are basically becoming glorified high school diplomas. So you're going to see more and more, younger people with high levels of education that their economic expectations are high, but what they're actually getting economically doesn't meet their expectations. It doesn't meet what someone with traditionally their level of education is expected to bring them. I think that's going to take a while for all of this to sink in, though. I don't think that this is something that's going to happen overnight. That all of a sudden there's going to be people out there with protest signs, overthrow the plutocracy or something like that. I mean, we see these little inklings of that pop up here and there. You know, we saw the anti-globalization movement back in the late 90s, early 2000s. We saw this Occupy Wall Street thing a few years ago, and that flared up for a little while and then kind of fizzled out. But I think that at some point, down the road, there'll be something else like that, only in a bigger way. But it's not going to happen overnight. I think that a lot of people out there really haven't started to grasp what the economic situation is going to be like in the future. I know, for example, I deal with college students all the time, and a lot of them, seem to me to be extremely overconfident in terms of what they're going to be able to do when they get their educations and what their career prospects and financial futures are going to be. And I think as they get out there into the world and get older, I think their all their illusions of that kind are going to be dashed. And then I think that's going to have a radicalizing effect as well.
And I pointed this out earlier. We see an alliance in California between the underclass and the upper class. What's his name? Kotkin calls it an upstairs downstairs coalition. Could you see a scenario like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who represents sort of an underclass opposition to the elites as opposed to a middle class opposition?
That's possible. I think the main implication of that, the fact that you have this upper class, lower class alliance within the Democratic Party, is that that's going to be a very unstable coalition over time. And I think that's going to be particularly true as these wider sets of cleavages that you find among all the different constituent groups on the left, as those cleavages start to become more apparent, I think that the what I call the PC coalition is going to crack up eventually, new political alignments will probably come out of that. But I think though that the main dividing line we're going to see when a new political paradigm emerges, and it's going to be a few decades probably. But when this new political paradigm emerges that replaces this Obama paradigm, I think that one of its defining characteristics is going to be that one of the major fault lines is class. It's going to be the wealthy and affluent versus everyone else. Now, beyond that, in terms of what the specifics of it would be, it's hard to guess, but it does seem like class polarization is really becoming one of the primary dividing lines in our own society. It's also the case that our society may become more and more fractious just through things like demographic change. The fact that there is less and less of a common cultural identity or commonly shared set of cultural norms. We may see a society-wide fracturing along socioeconomic lines and between those who are connected to the system politically and those who aren't. And then within that framework, we might see a lot of sub-fractures, if you will, along demographic and cultural lines. As immigrant populations grow, as the white middle America WASPish population shrinks and so forth, as the various traditional out-groups start having more and more conflicts with one another.
And that's the thing. I mean, a lot of middle class people, they still hold on to this notion that there's this American dream that if you work hard, you get a college education, you can become successful. But the future is basically, in order to become wealthy, you have to have some sort of special connections through either government or business or through your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, even today, you know, the mainstream political right, if you listen to their rhetoric, it's the same thing that Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan used to talk about welfare queens, and you know what's really wrong with the world is too many people on food stamps driving Cadillacs and that kind of stuff. I mean, that's the kind of view of political economy that these people tend to have. That you know what makes things work economically is people have to go out and work hard and get an education and have a good Protestant work ethic and be self-reliant and people who aren't making it in the system, it's because they're not working hard enough. And if the economy's not doing well, it's because there's too many people that you're on public assistance and those kinds of things. I mean, I have conversations with people who hold to that view all the time. And, you know, what I always find among them is that they have just a very limited understanding of how the American political and economic systems actually works. I mean, some of these people have never even heard, for example, of corporate welfare. To hear them tell the story, you'd think there was no such thing. When you talk to them about issues like health care reform, they think, well, what's really wrong with health care reform is Obama wants to have socialized medicine. You know, as if you know there wasn't plenty of state interference in healthcare before. But that kind of that way of thinking, I believe, will probably recede as economic conditions become more dire. For example, during the prosperity that a certain sector saw during the 1920s, that kind of thinking was fairly prevalent as well. You know, it all of a sudden dried up a bit after the Depression in the 1930s. During that time, you saw plenty of populist movements, plenty of movements from the left and from the right.
You had people during the World War II era, like Father Coughlin, for instance.
Sure, absolutely.
And Huey Long.
Sure.
And that also in the early 20th century, before the Great Depression. But then after World War II, we really saw that in the 60s, we saw the beginning of the current sort of liberal versus conservative dichotomy.
Yeah, well, in the post-World War II era, that was a time of tremendous economic prosperity. In the United States, during that time, there was unprecedented economic expansion, and you had all of these war industries that had developed during the war that were being converted into, you know, manufacturing industries that were manufacturing consumer goods and making TVs and microwave ovens and stuff like that. And, you know, if you were a working class person, your dream was to get a job as a factory worker in an industrial plant where you'd pretty much have job security for life and you'd have much higher wages than the generation before you ever had. And you know, during that time, the working class became a middle class. The people who would have been considered working class in previous generations had achieved middle class lifestyles. You saw, you know, hourly wage workers living in middle class suburbs in the 50s and 60s. So that was a time of tremendous economic prosperity. And in fact, I'd argue that a lot of the social and the social and cultural upheaval that you saw in the 60s was generated largely by the economic prosperity that came out of the late 40s and 50s and early 60s. Because if you look at the issues that drove radicals in the 60s, very little of it was economics based. Most of it was cultural. There was the civil rights movement in the South among blacks, but that was a somewhat separate matter, I think. But for the most part, cultural radicalism in the 60s was about being against the draft. You know, we don't want to go to war and get killed for some dubious cause. You know, war is icky. That was all about, you started getting into these ideas like find yourself, explore yourself, know yourself, the rise of pop psychology, that kind of thing. The sexual revolution. We don't want to be constrained by these middle class Victorian sexual mores. You know, we've got the pill now. We've got penicillin now. We can explore sexual interests. The drug culture. You know, all of these kinds of things, I think, represented the fact that this was an affluent society that had time to think about all that kind of stuff, you know, gay lib and you know, that kind of stuff. But I think that the next wave of radicalism we see in our own society is going to be more like what we had in the early 20th century, where it was about class polarization. And it was about the fact that there was a lot of people that couldn't meet their basic material needs. And I think that that's really going to be the one of the principal, if not the principal, fault line in the future of American politics when the next paradigm arrives. I think right now, the Obama paradigm, I think, represents the victory of the anti-WASP forces, if you will. You know, if you look at all the different kinds of constituent groups and political interest groups that make up the Obama coalition and the Democratic Party and the center left as it's currently defined in the United States, if you look for one identifying thread, it's basically the anti-WASP party. It's the party of all of the different social and cultural and demographic and religious and other forces that are not part of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant paradigm. And if you look at all the different at voting trends and elections, you see that. And I think that's really, you know, like I've heard it said that the Obama administration is George McGovern's revenge. You know, in the early 70s, the new left went into the Democratic Party. They took it over. McGovern got trounced in the elections. The Democratic Party was essentially a minor party for decades after that. Then, in fact, the only two presidents that got elected for 40 years for the Democratic Party were Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter, both of whom were from the South and presented themselves as sort of right of center, you know, almost conservative Democrats when they ran for when they were running for election, you know, whatever they believe privately may be a separate matter. But I think we're in that's come full circle now, where the Obama administration really is the consolidation of the cultural revolution of the 60s and the 70s. It's come full circle now, where that paradigm is now the majority. And
but I think, combined with pro-rich economics.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's part of the new paradigm, because, like I said, the cultural radicalism of the 60s was not a class-based radicalism in a traditional sense of rich and poor. I think if anything, it was a case where you had rising expectations in the society. You had a rising middle class. You had a working class that had become a middle class. You had the growth of an upper middle class through things like the technological expansion, through things like the growth of the public sector bureaucracy, through the growth of mass corporations and
the managerial revolution that James Burnham talks about.
The managerial revolution. You also saw a rising middle class among the minority groups. You saw, as I said earlier, you saw a lot of this economic prosperity, I think, created a material base where, you know, former out groups could come along and start demanding political rights and that kind of thing. For example, the women's movement is an interesting example. I think what made the women's movement possible in part was the fact that the economy became so sophisticated that there was a need for an ever greater supply of skilled and educated workers, which meant the women had to be utilized as a sort of a reserve labor force or integrated into the labor force for that purpose. That in turn created an economic base for something like the women's movement to appear. And you start seeing during that time, like I said, a growing interest in consumer rights and the environment and health consciousness and that kind of stuff that you hadn't really seen before. But all of those are marks of an affluent society, you know, people who have time to care about that kind of stuff. You know, when people are just trying to feed themselves, they don't really worry much about things like that. And I think, like I said, you know, I think that in turn is to a large degree what created neoliberalism, is the fact that you did have this cultural radicalism that emerged among people who were upwardly mobile. And then this, you know, and then that whole demographic appeared in the 60s and 70s. It reinvented itself as the yuppie class in the 80s and 90s. It started to gradually take power politically, and now it is in power. It is the dominant paradigm. And I think it's going to stay there for a while. You know, I don't think it's going to go away. It'll probably be the dominant paradigm for a few more decades. But during the decades ahead, we'll start to see more and more cracks in all of that, I think. We'll start to see class polarization continuing to grow, different constituent groups on the left turning on each other. We'll start to see a shrinking middle class that becomes more radicalized and so forth.
So you've posted some articles about the American prison system.
Yes.
So obviously the situation in America is that America is sort of it's a country that's long sort of prized itself as a beacon of human rights and a beacon of freedom, but we are 5% of the world's population, but we have at least a quarter of the world's prison population.
Yes, and that's really a rather astounding statistic when you think about the fact that America imprisons a higher proportion of its people than any other country in the world. Not only do we have the largest number of prisoners anywhere in the world, but we have the largest per capita incarceration rate as well. So we are the leading prisoner nation, no doubt about it. More so than China, more so than India, more so than Russia, more so than Iran. All of those countries that the United States frequently criticizes for its lack of human rights or and things like that.
That is a major basis of American foreign policy, is the idea of that America is has the moral high ground, and all these other countries like Iran and Russia and China, they are basically countries that abuse human rights.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most frequent claim, and you hear claims like that coming from the establishment, from both the left and the right. But it's really very embarrassing to the United States to have such a huge prison population. And, there's one of two things that can really explain the reason for this high incarceration rate. One would be that Americans are simply uniquely evil people, that we just have so many bad people, we have to have this huge prison population to keep them all at bay. Or there's simply too many rules, and that there are other factors that go into making this huge prison population what it is. And I think it's pretty obvious. It's been well studied, well observed, that the prison industrial complex, as it's commonly called, is a big money-making enterprise. It is to domestic policy what the military industrial complex is to foreign policy. The military industrial complex represents a set of vested economic interests that profit immensely from the production of our archaic weapon systems and things that have no defensive purpose and no foreign policy purpose whatsoever. And likewise, domestically, with the prison industrial complex, we see the same thing. We see a vast array of vested economic and professional interests that profit immensely from these enormous incarceration rates. That, we have companies that get a lot of money to build prisons. These are private companies. We have huge corporations that this is their entire business. There was a scandal in Pennsylvania a few years ago about a judge who was more or less sending kids to prison just so some of these private prison facilities can have a steady supply of inmates. And I think this guy was taking bribes, or he was on the payroll or something of some private prison company secretly. I don't remember all the details of the case. It was something like that. And that kind of thing is very, very common. And prisons in some – what's interesting is that prison construction in some poor rural communities now has been a big business. And for a lot of these poor rural working people, getting a job as a prison guard is considered upward mobility. When I was teaching at one point, I was teaching a class of a college class of a lot of older adult students. We're talking about students in their 30s and 40s, and many of whom were actually corrections officers. And a lot of these were working class people who had made their living staffing some of these facilities. So it's really interesting to see what a huge money-making enterprise this has become.
And the other article, you put out a report, it says that more men are raped in this country than women.
Well, yeah, because when you figure up rape statistics in the United States, if you add prison rapes, which usually that's not included in rape statistics. Rape statistics, normally are gathered in the more conventional sense of, arrest for the charge of rape and victim identification and so forth. And if you figure up rape statistics in that way, then yeah, you'd probably find that there are more women who are rape victims than men. But if you add up prison rapes and the frequency with which that occurs, then you would have to say that men are actually more likely to be victimized by rape than women, which is really a rather phenomenal thing, and that's something that the prison industrial complex has created.
And it's ingrained, it's ingrained in American culture, where a lot of people, it's in movies, whenever you read a story about somebody who's if you read about like a high-profile criminal and you look down in the comment section and people are joking about it, it's so ingrained in the culture that's actually accepted as part of the punishment for committing a crime.
Yeah. Well, there are plenty of jokes about that. Whenever you have some high-profile criminal that gets busted, like you were saying, if you read the comments section, if you listen to what people say, yeah, well, he's going to get, whatever, up to whatever, So,
I don't think Americans – I mean, I think – I don't think Americans are – inherently moral people. I think Americans are, in a sense, less. I think Americans have a lower moral compass than people in other parts of the world.
Well, a case could be made for that on some level. One thing that's interesting about American society is that culturally, because commercial values are such a part of our own cultural norms, and everything is viewed in terms of what's profitable and what's not, I do think that does cultivate a wider set of cultural values where things like community and social solidarity and that kind of thing start taking a back seat, and it's all sort of about values like looking out for number one, get over on the next guy, that kind of thing, do start coming to a forefront. I think that's to be predicted in a society where the values of culture, where the values of commerce and upward mobility and that kind of thing tend to be so dominant.
Yeah, and people are detached from other people. So someone who does not, say, know a person or family member who's, say, incarcerated, they basically dehumanize the people, and it's a culture where people are into the media and into a consumerist culture where they dehumanize other people.
Yeah, well, I've heard it said before. There was an old joke, about liberals, about a conservative being a liberal who's been mugged, and the joke, but what that joke meant, of course, was that, well, liberals have a reputation, or used to have a reputation, for being soft on crime, and all of a sudden, if a liberal gets mugged, he or she will turn around and become a law and order conservative. But I've heard a corollary joke that says that a libertarian is a conservative who's been arrested, which means that, you'll find people who have this kind of staunch, lock them up and throw away the key type of approach to law and order, suddenly doing an about face when they or one of their friends or someone in their family all of a sudden comes up against the criminal justice system. And that's an interesting phenomenon to observe as well.
And another thing about the criminal justice system among white conservatives, if you talk to them, they're totally horrified by if they find out someone's a white nationalist, but then on the other hand, they support extreme policies against minority groups that are far more inhumane than even segregation.
Well, yeah, one effect of the criminal justice system in its present form and the related prison industrial complex is that, there's a whole lot more racial minorities who are actually incarcerated now than there were in the pre-civil rights era. I've seen data that shows that something like 1 in 3 black males will serve time in prison at some point in their life. A few years ago, I saw some data that showed that something like 50% of black youth in their 20s were either in jail or in prison or on probation or on parole. In other words, under some kind of supervision of the criminal justice system, which wasn't the case, say in the 1950s, whatever other issues there may have been back then. So, yeah, that's one of the effects that this has had among the poorest racial minorities is that it has contributed to their mass incarceration, and they have become sort of a surplus population that are warehoused in these institutions.
And basically, you have large numbers of people who are nonviolent drug offenders, and they become hardened criminals, and it's real. And then when most of those people are going to get out at some point, and they can't get work, and they're going to be a huge. There's people who aren't necessarily dangerous, but they become dangerous people after they're let out of prison.
Well, the old saying that says that prisons are schools for crime has much merit to it. I've known a whole lot of convicts and a whole lot of criminal types myself, and if you talk to them about this, I mean, most of them will say that they learned many of their skills in prison as far as how to commit crimes more effectively. I knew one fellow once who was a professional embezzler, and he'd been to prison several times for embezzlement. And he said each time he went to prison, he always learned how to apply his trade more effectively because he was with so many of his own kind and they compare notes and things like that. But yeah, one thing I think you said though that's particularly important is that most people in prison will get out eventually, except for people that are have mandatory life sentences or people on death row. You have to wonder what kind of people are they going to be. Someone that in the 80s and 90s with things like mandatory sentencing and drug cases and stuff like that, you started seeing more and more 18-year-olds being sent to prison for 10 years for being some minor accessory to a drug deal or something like that, or someone that has no history of violence being sentenced to 30 years in prison for some petty set of drug sales or something. And all those people are still in or have been in. And what kind of people are they going to be when they come out? What kind of people are they now if they've already gotten out? We're talking about someone that's not developing any job skills. It's not developing any social networks. It's not developing any education.
But they're not developing job sales for themselves, but they're providing jobs for other people.
Yeah, but the big thing is, how are these people going to be reintegrated into society at some point in the future? And I think that that's going to be a big social issue at some point in the future. The fact that you have all of these ex-convicts out there running around in society, people who were, becoming older and older, people in their 40s and 50s and 60s who still can't get jobs because of their criminal records for stuff they did in their teens and 20s.
And the other thing about it is it's not fiscally sustainable. I mean, in California, Jerry Brown is actually doing this realignment where he's actually having to release people from prison. So it's the first time you look at a graph of the growth in the prison population, it's basically been growing since the 1970s, but now in some ways it's starting to hit a plateau simply because they don't have the fiscal resources for that.
Yeah, I first started noticing that a couple of years ago, that it looked like the prison population was going to peak and then level off, and I think you're right that that's what's driving it, is the fact that it's simply become too expensive with more and more states and counties on the verge of bankruptcy now, and particularly somewhere like California that's in dire straits in terms of its fiscal issues. They just can't simply afford to have people being kept in prison at the cost of millions of people being kept in prison at the cost of tens of thousands of dollars a year. I know there's an attorney general here in Virginia, a guy named Cuccinelli, who's a staunch, conservative, religious right, Tea Party, pro-life type of guy, who even he said recently that if you're going to pay, if you're going to spend $30,000 or $40,000 a year to keep somebody incarcerated, there'd better be a good reason for it.
You're saying 30,000. That's about that's the cost. Yes. That's about the cost to go to a good university.
Yeah. Exactly. For the cost of what it costs to keep someone in prison for a year, you could probably send them to a decent quality university for a year. Yes.
So, Keith, I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.